Hello, I'm Mercedes.
And I'm Tash.
And you're listening to episode 247 of Chat Disney. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Chat Disney podcast. And this week we have got something very, very special indeed for you. We have got an episode dedicated to the brand new Walt Disney animated classic, which is, of course, Wish. This is a movie that has been created especially to celebrate Disney 100, the 100th anniversary of the Walt Disney Company. And it is an honor to be talking about the movie in depth with Tash today in the episode. But before we do so, let's have a quick look at what's been happening in the world of Disney this week.
Kicking off with some Walt Disney World news today, and probably my favourite piece of news to come out of the world of Disney this week. Snow White's animatronic arm was stolen by none other than Dopey himself on the Seven Dwarves mine train. Now, people who were going on the ride, when it goes through the bit where you can see them through the window in the house, they could see that her arm was missing and it was in Dopey's hand. Very, very comical indeed. I'm sure it has been fixed by now, in case you are thinking you're going to hop on it and check it out for yourself. Other exciting news in Walt Disney World, the Hatbox Ghost is now officially in the Haunted Mansion. This has been teased for a little while and he is now officially there. So a big, big welcome to the legendary Hatbox Ghost. And finally for Walt Disney World today, we have had the first look at the Walt the Dreamer statue, which is officially opening on December the 5th in the World Celebration Gardens in Epcot. Now, this statue was teased earlier this year and it really is a lovely statue. It's based on Walt in his later life. It's a very reflective piece of art, so definitely check it out online unless you are lucky enough to be going to Walt Disney World anytime soon and you can check it out in the flesh for yourself.
Love that. And heading over to Shanghai Disney Resort this week for our final bit of news. And we've had our first look at the Zootopia or Zootropolis cast member uniform. So cast members who work in the Zootopia area were recently invited to a cast exclusive fashion show for a big reveal of their new ensemble. Super exciting. And go ahead and give it a little Google if you want to see it for yourself. And that is pretty much everything that's been happening in the world of Disney this week. We would like you to now go ahead, close your eyes, and make a little wish as we head into the main part of today's episode.
So, we have not discussed this at all yet. We have both seen the film. We saw it separately. I have absolutely no idea what Mercedes thought of it and vice versa. So just before we get into our thoughts, to kind of set the background a little bit, Wish is one of those movies that has been really, really hyped up by Disney. You know, we had things like the Usher meet and greet in Walt Disney World ahead of the film's release. We had tons and tons of merchandise available on Shop Disney, and they were really, really pushing this movie that was celebrating 100 years of Disney. So I was very excited. I thought the trailers looked pretty decent. We knew that we were going to have a new style of animation with this, which was going to be a mix of sort of watercolor and CGI. And then, of course, it premiered and we got the critics' reviews. And I think it's fair to say that there were a few mixed reviews, but they were mostly on the side of negative, with a lot of people saying that it felt like a big marketing ploy for the Walt Disney Company. It didn't really have any heart. The story was weak. The characters were weak. So this really disappointed me and made me very apprehensive about seeing the movie. I did check the IMDb score for the film before I went ahead and saw it, and it is a 5.9, which is very, very bad for a Disney
movie. That's terrible for a Disney movie. It's terrible for IMDb, but more importantly, it's really bad for a brand new film. Typically, what happens when a film comes out is it normally has a slightly inflated score on IMDb. So 5.9 right now in opening weekend means it's probably going to average more around a 5 once it's been out for a little while. That's quite shocking. I'm actually very surprised by that.
It is. My heart really sank when I saw that. However, I have to say, In a way, there was part of me that was quite glad for the negative reviews because it meant that I ended up going in without a massively high expectation. I kind of went in already being disappointed because I had hyped this movie up so much. I thought it was going to be better than Encanto. I thought it was going to be like the next greatest thing. And then when I actually went to see it at the cinema, I was like, okay, don't get your hopes up. It's probably not going to be that great. Yeah. So what was your sort of thoughts going into it?
I never, even from the trailers and things, I never had high expectations anyway. And then, so yeah, I never thought this is going to be like the next Encanto, the next Frozen or anything like that. And I think if I'm being completely honest, I base that on the fact that I've been really disappointed with the last few Disney movies, Raya and the Last Dragon, Strange World. I mean, come on, they've been churning out absolute rubbish recently. So I had really low expectations because of that. And then when the critics' reviews came out, it actually gave me a bit of optimism because the reason that the critics were reviewing it so badly is because they were saying it was too nostalgic and too, like you say, oh, they're just thinking about marketing. They're just dropping all these Easter eggs in, you know. And I was like, oh, lots of Easter eggs, lots of nostalgia. Sounds like a bit of me. So actually, I then had a bit more. So I guess I kind of went into it with no expectation, I would say. I wasn't blown away by the trailer. None of the characters particularly appealed to me. The animation style didn't really particularly appeal to me in the trailer. None of the music that I had heard did. So I was just kind of like, I'm not really sure what to expect from this. And then hearing that there were Easter eggs and nostalgia and things, which although the critics had said was a bad thing, that kind of piqued my interest a little bit more.
Definitely. So I think the thing with the Easter eggs and going in knowing that did kind of hinder my experience a little bit because I was constantly on the lookout for them. Right. And there were, as we will get into talking about, there were some really blindingly obvious ones. And then there were some that were a lot more subtle that you maybe wouldn't have got unless you were a real hardcore Disney fan. Yeah. And I think I would have loved it if I'd have gone in and just been like, oh my God, that represents so-and-so and that references this and that is this and da-da-da-da-da, rather than constantly being kind of on the lookout for them. It meant that I couldn't fully relax and enjoy the movie.
Interesting. I knew that took away from my experience, but I think that probably says more about you and I because you don't like any spoilers at all. Whereas I tend to enjoy things when I've done a bit of research. So I think for me, knowing that didn't really do anything for me. One thing I want to talk about before we go into the movie, it was a few things actually. The first one that I thought was really, really interesting in my research before we went into the cinema. So we'll get you all into the headspace I was in, if you will. I don't know how to start with this, Tash. I guess I'll ask you a question. Do you remember that Walt Disney Studios were developing a Jack and the Beanstalk movie called Gigantic?
Yes, I do.
Now, this wasn't a secret, right? So Disney used to be very vocal about what they were developing. And you could go on like Wikipedia and they'd have all of that. Like I knew about Frozen, the Snow Queen, years before Tangled was the same. I remember like looking it up frequently as like a young adult teenager. And Jack and the Beanstalk was one of the, I think it was meant to come out after Frozen, to be honest with you, like Gigantic. We've known about Gigantic for a really, really long time. For those of you that are really familiar with Zootopia, there's that scene where Duke Weaselton has the like dodgy DVDs and one of them is clearly Moana. One of them is clearly Frozen. Have a look again and you'll see Gigantic is represented there as well. So at the time of developing Zootopia, the Walt Disney Studios animation department still had every intention of developing Gigantic. I'm not sure what changed, but that project has been axed now. They are not bringing this movie out. And you might be thinking, okay, great, what's that got to do with Wish? I heard a rumor, and it is a rumor, and I heard this before I went in, but I'm kind of glad I knew it, but also it kind of ruined the movie a little bit for me. I heard a rumor that some of the songs that were written for Gigantic were used in Wish. And when we get to talk about this, there is one song in particular that if I had to, I'm not a betting woman, but if I had to make a bet that this is the song that was taken from Gigantic, I'm like 100% sure it's this song because it's a fantastic song, but it does not fit the film. It doesn't progress the narrative. It actually sounds like it's something else. Tash is pulling a very bemused face, like trying to guess what I'm thinking. Yeah. So Tash is like trying to guess what I'm thinking. we'll talk about it when we get into it, but like, I'm really pleased you don't know, because that means that this song didn't feel displaced.
There's only one which I think is displaced, but I wouldn't describe it as a fantastic piece of music.
I'm really glad you just said that, because I think we both have the same views about a different song. So I'll talk about that in a second. But no, there's one song in particular that I loved, and actually probably would say it's my favourite song from the film, but it does not fit. So I think that's the Gigantic song.
Interesting. So let's just go straight into it. It's always hard to do these things really cryptic and not give away what we thought of them until the end. So spoiler alert, I'm just going to go in and say what I thought. I actually really love this film. I definitely have big issues with some of the character development and the plot points, which is basically what I said with Encanto as well. It reminded me of kind of how I felt about that. And again, the same thing. I came out of Encanto thinking the soundtrack was okay. Like, we don't talk about Bruno was really good, but you know, the rest of the songs, I can't really remember them. And then the more I listened to that soundtrack, the more I enjoyed it. And the same thing is happening to me with Wish as well. So kind of my journey of Wish and my experience of it is very similar to how I felt about Encanto when that came out.
Well, the Encanto loyalist in me just died a little bit, Tash. I would never compare this movie to the Disney classic masterpiece, Encanto. I liked the film. I did. It is considerably better than the absolute rubbish that Disney have been churning out of late. And I am pleased for that. Do I think this movie is worthy of Disney 100? We'll answer that question at the end of today once we've spoken through what I liked, my niggles. I have a lot of niggles. I wish I didn't. I do. I did really like it, but, and it's a big but, for me, Tangled, Princess and the Frog, Frozen, Encanto, these movies are heads and tails above Wish. I liked it more than Moana, but I don't love Moana. I definitely liked it more than Raya and the Last Dragon and Strange World. I think I prefer Zootopia. I like it as much as I like Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah, I would pretty much agree with all of those. It's definitely not their strongest piece of work, but I think it is definitely better than, yeah, some of the stuff that they have been churning out lately. So I think we're in agreement there. So let's start by talking about the story.
Should we just go through the movie?
Sure.
Let's do that. Spoils for everyone. Spoils? Yeah. Spoilers.
Spoilers. This is your warning.
This is like a proper warning. I think let's go through the movie, because then we can talk about the characters as we go.
Okay, we'll do that rather than talking about it in terms of like plot, characters. Exactly. Yeah.
We'll flow through. We'll see what we can remember. It was a while ago that I saw it.
So we have that opening, which is a nod to the classic, the Disney classics from, you know, the golden era opening, where we have it with a proper fairy tale style book that opens. They set the scene. They basically allude to what the film is going to be about, the character of the king. And straight away, it's that classic nod. It's our first kind of Easter egg, if you will, to, you know, 100 years of Disney. It's harking right back to the way Snow White started in 1937. So it takes you back initially. So that, for me, I was like, oh yeah, I remember when they used to do this. And why did they ever stop doing this? I like that. It's very, very fairy tale-y. But obviously this is a brand new original fairy tale. But you know instantly that that's the vibe that they're going for with this movie.
I completely agree. And I think that that's what they want us to say. And that's what they want us to think. But there's something about the way they did the book that felt to me really inauthentic. And it felt like a parody. Like, you know, Shrek starts with a book.
Yes.
It didn't feel like Snow White or Sleeping Beauty or Cinderella. It felt a parody, the book. I don't know why. I wonder if it's because I say I don't know. And then I'm like, oh, actually, it might be because if you go back and watch Snow White, Pinocchio, Sleeping Beauty, the book was real. They actually used to film that. That's not animation. And I feel like it was CGI in this. And maybe that's why. I don't really know, but I loved it. It's the perfect opening. But it felt like a parody.
I feel like it's also that thing of like, we don't see that anymore. but we do see it, as you mentioned, in Shrek. And it's that classic thing of like, this is a trope from old fairy tale movies, and we're making a parody of that, so this is what we're going to use. Does that make sense? So like,
yeah, like this isn't an old 1950s no. Disney. Like that I agree. And I think that's kind of, I have to say, actually, I'm going to sound like the critics now, we're going around in a circle. That's my issue with this. For Disney 100, all of the things we're going to talk about today that I had slightly niggles with, for Disney 100, I would have liked them to come out with their best movie for like the last 20 years, like another Frozen, another Tangled. But this is like, it feels like a parody of all the ones that have gone before.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And again, kind of going off on a tangent here, but you know, we always talk about what, you know, those famous words that Walt said about always moving forward. And how great would it have been if they'd have come out with something completely unique and original.
Like Encanto. Encanto would be great for Disney 100.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally agree.
Anyway, so that's that. But I get what you're saying. I'm being cynical because I don't know, it just really gave me Shrek vibes. So you're right. We've got this set up, and then there's a few key characters that we're instantly introduced to. And the first of which is our heroine, Asha, who is mixed race, which is so exciting. Our first mixed race Disney princess. And we know this for a fact because we see her mother and her father depicted in the film. Her father is white. Her mother is black. Love this. Again, going to be niggly. This is just me, and this has nothing to do with the film, but I have to say this. I'm really frustrated and disappointed to see that Asha is clearly mixed race. It's very, very clear from the movie. And then when we see her in the Disney parks, or we have seen her in the Disney parks recently, she has not been portrayed by a mixed race actress, or what I can tell. Obviously, you can never truly know someone's heritage, but the actresses that I've seen portray her in the Walt Disney parks have just been black. And I think the reason they've probably done that is because of princesses like Tiana. I assume they're people who are friends with Tiana and also Asha, if you catch my drift. But yeah, I haven't seen any Ashas that look like she does in the movie that are actually mixed race. And I think that's disappointing. Completely off topic for the film, but just a side note.
Yeah, no, I haven't either. I think you're quite right there. But yeah, I think that as our, you know, Disney heroines go, I can definitely see her being, you know, introduced into the official lineup of the Disney princesses. She is our first Disney princess that, of course, has braids as well. So I think kind of sticking to that, I don't know, like the kind of mixed race heritage almost, if that makes sense. I think that they've really tried to kind of be true, like with what's the word that I'm looking for? I can't think of the word. It will come to me. It will come to me in a minute, and I'll suddenly remember it like halfway through.
Even her freckles as well. Like freckles are something that are really, really common in light skinned black people and mixed race people. You think about like Meghan Markle, and she's very light skin with freckles. Like I think they've done a really good job with the representation of Asha. And as I say, I think like maybe even our first mixed race character, like let alone princess. So I love her appearance. I love what she stands for. I love the representation, but I also genuinely loved her as a character as well. So big tick for me.
Yeah, she was a great character, I thought. The animation, of course, this is one of the first things that you notice as well when you go to see this movie. Now, a lot of the reviews I have said, the negative ones, their one positive is the animation. And I found it really jarring. I don't know about you, but I couldn't get over the kind of the difference between the watercolor background, which was stunning, but then mixed with the CGI, like, it just, I think I did get used to it as the movie went on because I guess I just got used to it and it didn't become such an issue. But at the beginning, I did find it incredibly jarring. I wasn't a fan.
Yeah, so Jennifer Lee, who is the creative director of the Walt Disney Studios animation department, said that their idea for the animation style was that it paid homage to the classics, and Sleeping Beauty is the most obvious. As you say, Tash, it's watercolor, and all of Sleeping Beauty was painted in watercolor. And there's so many scenes, especially the cottages and things, that are very, very reminiscent of Sleeping Beauty. And we'll talk about Sleeping Beauty a lot today, I'm sure, because there's lots of parallels. However, they wanted to use, as you say, in the words of Walt, keep moving forward, they wanted to use modern day technology to achieve this, hence the CGI. I hated it. I thought it looked awful. Like, there's a reason that that's not done, right? Like, don't, again, it's like, just make a good film. Don't think too much about the fact that it's Disney 100 and just make a good film. I think the fact that they were like, oh, we want it to be reminiscent, I think it hindered. I would have actually preferred they'd gone back to hand-drawn or watercolour, but using the CGI, it looked, my sister said this to me actually, so I'm stealing this from her, but it looked very much to me like a Zelda video game. She didn't actually say Zelda. She said it looks like a video game, but I think she was thinking Zelda. For any gamers who listen to the podcast, they'll know exactly what I'm talking about. It really looked to me like Zelda or some kind of like video game that's been remastered for like PS5. It just would know.
Yeah, I think actually that's a really good, yeah, I mean I'm not into video games anyway, and I generally hate the animation style in video games, but I can completely see what you mean. It does have that, I don't know, I just, as I say, I just found it really jarring. I think they tried too hard with it, and I would have preferred for them to just go back to hand-drawn animation. I really miss the days of hand-drawn animation, and I think if this movie had have been, you know, like Princess and the Frog and had gone back to hand-drawn in that way, that's still a great homage to the Walt Disney Company and what they produced all those years ago. I think by trying to kind of mix the two worlds together, it just didn't really work for me.
I completely agree. And so in this opening, we've got the storybook, we've got this new animation style introduced, we're introduced to our protagonist Asha, and then we're also introduced to our villain Magnifico, and it's quite apparent early on that he is the villain, which, little round of applause from the chat, Disney gals, Tash and I have been saying for a very long time that we're kind of over this whole twisted villain thing, and we're longing for a camp flamboyant villain who's just clearly the villain. And wow, we were given that in buckets with Magnifico. He's everything I've ever wanted from a villain. He might be my favorite character. It's very obvious from the beginning that he's the villain. However, I feel like it's not as ridiculous as someone like a Captain Hook or a Hades or a Maleficent, because he's still an authority figure. So it is still teaching children and young people a message of like, hey, just because someone is a leader or an authority doesn't mean that you should trust everything they tell you and that you should respect them. Respect is earned, trust is earned. And if somebody who is in a high powered position does something that you don't like or tells you something that you don't agree with, you should still stand up to them. So there's still like a message in there. But he's a flamboyant camp villain with some amazing villain songs. So I loved him.
I agree. I liked him as well. I love the fact that they made him really good looking. Like, they made him a bit of a silver fox. He wasn't like, you know, the old hag or like some hideous villain. I also like that he was quite realistic. I mean, obviously, you know, he sort of crumbles throughout the film and we see him become more and more evil, which I'm sure we will touch upon as well. But I like that he was like just quite a realistic baddie in the beginning. You know, he wasn't pure evil at heart at the start of the film, but he was just a bit, he was quite controlling. He was very narcissistic. He had a couple of comedy lines, which I liked. I do like a bit of a funny villain. But yeah, he was a bit of a bad egg, I would say, rather than being someone like Maleficent, who is just evil for the sake of being evil. It was almost like he tried to do good, but he had a bit of a, you know, he was just a bit of a bad apple.
Yeah, it was like the red flags are flagging, right? Yes. And like, I actually agreed with him in the beginning. Like, we'll get on to kind of, well, we'll talk about it now because we're going through sequence. So the whole thing that is set up, that Magnifico takes a wish from the citizens of Rosas when they're 18, and then every month he grants a wish and he chooses which wish he's going to grant. And we start with Asha's family, and her grandfather, her late father's dad, has just turned 100 years old. And that's, again, another Easter egg for the Disney 100. And he's never had his wish granted. And she goes to see Magnifico. She's going to become his apprentice. And she finds out that the reason that Magnifico has not granted her grandfather's wish is because it's too vague. His wish is to leave a legacy for younger generations to be proud of, but he doesn't specify. We know that from the visual and from the end of the movie that what he meant by that was as a musician, but he didn't actually specify that when he made the wish. And so Magnifico is like, what legacy does he want to leave? Like, he might want to start some kind of uprising. He might want to cause like some big rebel takeover of Rosas. Like, I can't just grant a wish if it's ambiguous. And I was like, too right. He's keeping the peace. He's a man of the peace. He's, you know, you can't just go around granting wishes. What if someone wished like for a natural disaster or something? I mean, that would, you know, be very concerning, but you can't just go around granting all these wishes. So I actually had some sympathy for Magnifico at that point. And you're right, Tash, we see him spiral into evil by the end of the movie. And I think he, in that descent, he reminded me of different Disney villains gone by at different stages. So like, he starts off, he's very Gaston, right? He's arrogant, narcissistic, loves himself. Then he becomes a bit Jafar-esque. He becomes this sorcerer and the power kind of goes to his head a little bit. By the end of the movie, he's full on Maleficent. Like, that final scene has got lots of Sleeping Beauty vibes, which we'll obviously talk about at the end because it's the end of the movie and we're going through sequence, even though I'm hopping all over the place. But yeah, I saw a lot of previous Disney villains within him kind of through that descent.
Yeah, definitely. And I love that because I love a Disney villain. And I think that he was kind of responsible for his own demise in a way, because, you know, at the beginning of the movie, like I said, he's not all evil. Like, I think he does have a good side to him. But I think that, you know, once he unlocks the forbidden magic, that's what it's called, that is kind of what takes over. And it's like he has no control over that. And it's the same thing that we, you know, is very, very reminiscent of what we see happen with Jafar at the end of Aladdin. I mean, Jafar is way more evil, I think, than Magnifico at the beginning of Aladdin. But even the way Magnifico has his, you know, ultimate comeuppance at the end when he's locked away in that, what's it called? A staff. Is a staff? Yeah, the staff is basically what happens to Jafar with the lamp. So another nice Easter egg there. So I love that. And I love that we had a lot of throwaway lines. So there's the bit with the mirror, mirror on the wall. Like, there were so many bits to him that you could definitely see how they had looked at probably all the other Disney villains and just made a complete mashup of this one kind of ultimate villain, which I really loved.
Not wearing black, red or purple, wearing white and blue. So there's the contemporary twist, moving away from kind of the signature villain outfit. Now, you spoke about Easter eggs there. So at this moment of where, you know, we've got this sorcerer, Magnifico, and Asha wants to be his apprentice. Some might call her a sorcerer's apprentice. I thought that was quite clever. And the reason we know all of this stuff that we know, that we just spoke about with Magnifico and so on, is obviously, you know, this is a musical. It's what Disney does best. And our first song is Welcome to Rosas. And that kind of sets this whole thing up. I didn't love it. I thought it was a cheap version of the Family Madrigal.
Literally, it was, as soon as it started, I was like, okay, this is Wish's answer to the Family Madrigal. I wasn't mad about it either. Having listened to it afterwards many times, I actually really do like this song. It's one of the stronger songs in the movie, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I really like it. And I think it does do a good job of setting the scene and kind of explaining what the movie is going to be about as well.
I skip it when I'm listening.
Do you? Oh, I really like it.
Oh, no, it's one of my least favourites. Maybe we're not going to agree when it comes to music. Now, music has been, I just had to Google her name because I'd completely forgotten. It's a woman called Julia Michaels, who, interestingly, Disney have got a bit of a reputation for kind of going after these musician or musical superstars from the stage. So we've seen that with Alan Menken, who's obviously very famous for Little Shop of Horrors. Lin-Manuel Miranda, very, very famous from Hamilton. The Anderson Lopez's, very famous from Book of Mormon. They normally kind of go to the stage, and I'm really surprised they haven't gone after whoever wrote Dear Evan Hansen yet. That hasn't happened. Instead, we've got Julia Michaels, who's a pop writer. She's written songs for the likes of Britney Spears, Selena Gomez, Justin Bieber. And that didn't really come across to me in this movie. I would have bet, like, everything I own that this had been written by whoever was responsible for The Greatest Showman. I actually don't know who wrote the music for The Greatest Showman, but I was getting such Greatest Showman vibes from this. I was shocked it was a pop composer.
Yeah, because there was another composer, Benjamin Rice, and he wrote the music for A Star Is Born, the Lady Gaga, Bradley Cooper. I was going to say Bradley.
He can't. But I knew you were going to say Bradley Walsh. He can't have written that, because the Barbara Streisand, did he write new songs?
Yeah, he wrote new songs. So he wrote In the Shallows and stuff. So he wrote like the updated music for that. I think so. I don't know. But he wrote some new music for that anyway. He had something to do with it. And David Metzger, who also was a composer for Frozen as well. So I can see where they, you know, they've tried to source a variety of people here. But I mean, yeah, if you ask me, I think just give Lin-Manuel Miranda a 10 movie contract and I'd be happy with that.
I completely, completely agree. I think, yeah, I think he could have, done his magic on this one. So we start with that song. And then, as I say, Asher goes into the castle, fortress, whatever it is, wants to become an apprentice, finds out about Magnifico, finds out a little bit more about him, and finds out that actually, as we've mentioned, he's not going to be casting just anyone's wish. But before we find this out, we have a song called, I can't remember, At All Costs, it's called, and it is a duet between Magnifico and Asher, something we don't really typically see. I think Frozen, Love is an Open Door, Prince Hans and Princess Anna is the only song that I can think of, which is a duet between our villain and our protagonist. This is the song. I love this song. It really reminds me of that song at the beginning of The Greatest Showman. I close my eyes and I can that. It really reminds me of that. I think this is one of the strongest songs from the movie. I think Chris Pine sounds beautiful. I think Ariana DeBose sounds beautiful. However, listen to the words of this song. It is 100% a mother and a father singing to a child. Like, I will protect you at all costs in my arms. Like, it's parents. I'm like, this isn't the villain and the hero singing about wishing. Like, why would he protect? I will protect you. Like, no. All of the other songs mention wishes, Rosas. Like, they all move the plot along. This song doesn't. It's a beautiful lullaby. It's gorgeous. I think it's the best song in the movie. But it's definitely like parents singing about a baby. Like, that's how I heard it.
Yeah, I mean, I did what I normally never, ever do. And on this one occasion, I actually listened to the soundtrack before seeing the movie. I know, I broke one of my rules. And hearing this song, I thought it sounded like a love song. And I was like, oh, there's going to be a love interest. But then I realised it was Chris Pine. And I was like, no, he's the villain. So is there going to be some sort of twist there? But no, I've seen from the trailers that he has a wife, so it really confused me and it really threw me off. But I quite liked that. I quite liked that when you listen to it, it sounds like something else, and then when you get to it, it's like, oh, they're actually thinking about something completely different. But it kind of does make sense. But I do agree, it doesn't move the plot along at all.
It's random. It's so random that I believe this is the song that was written for Gigantic. I reckon Jack's mother was going to sing it to him or something like that. I just can't see that this was written for this movie. It does not move the plot. It doesn't make sense that these two are singing a duet together. It is like a love song, but I see it more as a love song between like a parental love, like a protection love, which is why I think it was a mother and son or a father and a mother singing it to a baby. I've got the lyrics here. The first line, this is Magnifico. If happiness was a tangible thing, it would be you. If you'd have told me the feeling you'd bring, I'd think it untrue. And people search for a wonder like you all of their lives. You still amaze me after all this time. Who's he singing to?
Yeah, yeah.
Asher, is he singing to the wishes?
I think he's... See, this is where... So I don't know if I missed a plot point here. And we're going on to... This is kind of going to get us onto a new train of discussion. Because I went with my 7-year-old niece, and of course she needed the toilet at one point, so we did leave for 5 minutes so I could take her to the toilet. And I came back and I was like, I don't know if I've missed something here. But to me now, when I listen to that song back, it's almost like it reminds me of Mother Gothel in a way. You know, the way she kind of sings yes. to Rapunzel's hair, because yes. that's what keeps her alive. And she's not singing because she actually... you know, loves her hair. It's what the hair does to her. And I yes. kind of thought that, I was like, did I miss something in this movie? Do the wishes actually keep him alive? And that's what he's meaning, right? That's the purpose of what he's singing. Does that make sense? But I didn't get that from the plot. I don't know if I missed something.
It makes complete sense. You didn't miss anything. Later on in the movie, he learns that the wishes give him strength, but not at this point. And also the other reason that I'll tell you that that doesn't make sense anyway is because we've got all of that. It would be you. You know, you pull me in like some kind of wind. I don't want to leave, all of this. Then we've got Asher, right? Who's never stepped foot in the fortress before, never seen the wishes before, doesn't work for him, right? She says, what's pain when I look at you? No way I could explain you. Even if I tried to, I'll never dream like I used to. If someone tried to hurt you, I don't see how that could happen. I'd fight for you in ways you can't imagine. Who that is bit, she yeah, about?
That bit to me, that one line, I really like that song, but every time I listen to it, that one line, it always throws me off because it doesn't make sense.
Who are they singing about? Who do they both love? It does not make sense. And then both in harmony. And I promise you, as one does, I will protect you at all costs. I'll keep you safe here in my arms. I will protect you at all costs. If you're ever feeling like you're lost, I will find you. Man the fronts. There's no ocean I won't swim. It is a mother and a father to a child. I'm sorry, but it is.
Yeah, no, I think you are. I think you're probably right. Definitely. It's a love song. But I think, yeah, it is. It doesn't make any sense. And I think, yeah, it's a beautiful song. I really like it. But the movie could do without it. And I think that even if, you know, say they have taken it from Gigantic, it would be so easy to change a few of these words and keep it in.
Agreed. I don't know if it is from Gigantic. The word didn't sound like a word then, because that's just speculation I've seen. However, according to Disney Wiki, which I think is a very reliable source, it says here that originally when Benjamin Rice and Julia Michaels wrote the demo, it was a song that was a love story between two characters.
Mm-hmm.
So there we've just got our confirmation that this song was not originally written for these two characters, and it's so obvious. It stinks of just, it doesn't, it's awful.
Yeah,
it's not awful actually, it's my favorite song in the film, but it doesn't work for these two characters.
I think if they had gone with the aim, which is what I originally thought they were trying to do, is of two people singing the same song, but they're singing it in a very different way, they have a very different meaning behind it. She's singing about the wishes, he's singing about himself. I would have really liked, but the lyrics just don't make sense.
No, it's lazy, lazy, lazy. But my favourite song from the film. Moving swiftly on, as we've said, at this point, Asha realises that Magnifico will never grant her father's wish. And so she goes home, very upset, her grandfather, goes home, sees the grandfather, sees the mother, tells them they're outraged because essentially, I mean, we've got a bit of a North Korea situation here, haven't we? He's the head of the city. What he says goes. It's very much his way or the highway. They're you know, oh, Asha, you mustn't say these things about the king. They're nervous. They're scared that she's kind of, you know, rebelling. And she eventually runs off and goes to the wishing tree that her and her father used to sit at, and that's where she sings the big number from this song, from this movie, the belter, this wish, and she makes her wish on the star.
Yes, and this is my favorite song of the movie, but not this version. I do love this version, and I knew I loved it from before seeing the movie, but I just absolutely adore when we hear it again later on in the film, where we have kind of the uprising, we have that choral singing of everyone coming together, and there's so much heart and passion behind it. I love it.
Yeah, that is my second favourite song from this movie. So maybe we're more aligned on the music than we thought. And the star, his name is just Star. He's a little Easter egg. The silhouette on his face is the same shape as the silhouette on Mickey and Minnie's face. So there's another little Easter egg for us there. And Star comes down and creates a little bit of chaos. He starts granting all kinds of wishes, including making Valentino talk. And Valentino is, of course, Asha's little sidekick goat. What would a Disney princess be without her sidekick? Valentino was my favorite character from the entire film. I loved him. I was a little bit nervous in the trailer when I heard the voice that Alan Tudyk had chosen for him, but I loved him.
Oh, I wasn't fussed by Valentino. I think they were trying to create a new Olaf and it didn't land as much. There were a couple of like humorous lines, but nothing really, really funny. I did not like him. I wasn't in love with him.
Did you prefer Star?
I preferred Star. Star is, you know, a Disney marketer's absolute dream. He's so easy to sell on merchandise, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I really like Star. I thought Star was super cute. But yeah, Valentino was fine. But I think that I would have liked a bit more humour for it. It was like they tried to make him funny and I found it a bit cliche.
I liked him. I thought he was very different from Olaf because there was a sophistication to his comedy. Like, I loved that bit when he was like, I wish for a utopian metropolis where all mammals and prey and predators like are friends and we'll all get along and wear clothes. And it was like, oh, Zootopia. I loved Valentino. And yeah, my sister fell in love with Star. I fell in love with Valentino. And of course, these two characters had their shining moment in the song, I'm a Star. Now, I'm curious, Tash, is this the song you hated?
No. The song I hated can barely be called a song. We'll get to it shortly. But no, I did not like this.
I hated it. I
found this whole bit, and again, maybe I'm not being open-minded enough here, but I found this whole bit of the narrative so wishy-washy, and it just didn't make sense. You're a star. What? Like, I was like, is there going to be some twist, like, at the end? Like, are they all actually going to, like, turn into stuff? Like, what's going to happen? Like, I just found this whole bit of the story so wishy-washy and so vague. And I didn't like, there's the one bit I hate in this song, I feel like you're going to hate it too, is, like, when you have, like, that really, like, American dopey voice that's like, you're a star. Like, I just hated, like, all the different juxtapositions of all the voices coming in. Like, for me, this was, no, I didn't like it at all.
It was very Minion, very Illumination Studio, very Sing. I hated Watch Out World, Here I Are.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That gives me the ick. That voice annoys me more. That's Watch Out, Sorry. Oh, that whole that voice gives me more the ick than the dopey voice. No, this song was ick central. I hated that the bear was John, because it's obviously meant to be Little John. And then Bambi. I'm like, yeah. That's not Bambi. Like, don't go around calling. No, I hate it. I hated this song. It did progress the plot, because I get what you mean about it's vague. I feel like Disney can't make a movie at the moment without some vague plot point, like Elsa being a spirit or whatever it is. But them realizing that they are all stars is ultimately what saves the day at the end of the movie during your favorite song. So
it is, but it just, I like something a bit more concrete. I don't have that sort of like philosophic mind where it's all a bit abstract. Like, yeah. I like something more concrete, and this
is. Yeah, we all do. We all don't want some rubbish Encanto plot or Frozen 2 plot. And it was giving that. It was giving the energy of like, what do you mean we're a star? Are we special? Is everyone a star? Like, how do we? And also the way that, was it the squirrel that was like, come on, Asha, you know what? And it was like, what? Tell us. And then it's like, you're a star. And it's like, no, that's rubbish.
And like, Valentina's like, I've known the entire time. It's like, but what have, like, what?
What?
Yeah. Doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, you're special, I guess, but then they're all special at the end. And if everyone's special, it's the same thing as nobody is, as they say in The Incredibles. So yeah, I hated this. I absolutely hated it. And if you're doing like an homage to traditional Disney and you've got like talking woodland animals, this is giving Shrek, Minions, Madagascar, gross. Hated it. Absolutely hated it. So I'm assuming the next song in the movie is the one you hated then. I don't know. What did you hate?
What's the next song?
The next song is, so after this has happened, obviously there's that big light and everyone in the town's like, oh, a light. And everyone goes to Magnifico and he's getting quite angry at this point because everyone's like not doing exactly what he wants them to do because he's a bit of a dictator. And in response to this, he has another villain song. This is kind of his villain song, which is This Is the Thanks I Get, which I'm assuming.
Oh, no, I love this song.
I love this too.
What? Yeah. This is, I mean, I did say it's barely a song, that Bloomin' Chicken song.
Oh,
that massively gives me Small World vibes.
It gave me like Chicken Run. I didn't like the chickens either. It felt Minions.
Yeah, I was like, why? This was so, and that was an unnecessary plot point. But anyway, yeah, we've done that bit now.
Villain
song, I loved it. Love most villain songs. This one, I loved that it was really upbeat. I loved the way that it was filmed. I loved that we had things like the knights that came alive. There were like nods to Beauty and the Beast with like objects coming alive and him interacting with. I love that the song kind of takes that turn when he starts singing about the book, but then he's like, nope, I can't do it. It's like he's still got that bit of sense in him. He's not quite 100% evil at this point still. Really, really enjoyed this bit.
Yeah, I loved this as well. It gave me vibes of You're Welcome from Moana with with Maui and maybe a little bit of Mother Knows Best from Tangled. I really enjoyed this song a lot. I think Chris Pine has a fantastic voice, which we know from Into the Woods, but it was lovely to see him again in a Disney role where he was singing. So yeah, I was a really big fan of this. So obviously there's chaos in Rosas at this point. Everyone's aware of this star or whatever it is, a light, and everyone wants answers. And Magnifico is like, I need to find the source of this because someone else has magic. And Asher is the only citizen in Rosas, and of course the animals, that actually knows what's happened. And she and herself and Valentino and Star go back into the main city to try and attempt to steal all of the wishes from Magnifico and return them back to the citizens, the people whose wishes will never come true. But she is not alone. We are introduced to Asher's 7 best friends. Tash, how quickly did you get this reference?
Very quickly. I mean, we've already met them at this point, but as soon I was like, oh, there's 7 of them. Oh, that one's wearing glasses. Oh, she's also wearing red. Oh, he has a green top and a purple hat. Right, okay, I see where you're going with this. It was very obvious.
For me, the green hat and the purple hat and the green top was, and the big ears, I got immediately. And then one of them started sneezing and I was like, oh, okay. And the names as well, like Dahlia, Doc, Simon, Sleepy, they all begin with the same letters. I feel like I don't really know why they did that.
See, this is where I love an Easter egg and I loved a lot of the subtle references. This was too obvious for me. If she'd have had just Dahlia and Dahlia had been based on Doc, that I could have got on board with. But there was something we didn't, it was very obvious that the 7 characters had been put in it for the sake of representing the 7 dwarves. The only ones we really got to see anything of were the one who goes a bit bad at the end, Simon, is
Simon.
It?
Yeah.
Grumpy, whatever his name is, and Dahlia. The rest are very...
Grumpy's called like Groucho or something.
The rest are all Barbo? Very two-dimensional and very unnecessary. I think it would have been much better if they'd have just stuck with Dahlia based on Doc, and I would have been happy with that.
Or, like, do some other psychic. You don't need 7. I think 7 friends was quite overwhelming. Like, do you like a Timon and Pumbaa reference, or like a Figaro and Cleo reference, or I don't know, anything else. 3 good fairies. Like, there's so many Sleeping Beauty things in here. She could have had 3 friends, Flora, Fauna and Merryweather. It could have been like Megan, Fiona and Francesca or whatever. I don't know. Like, I feel like it was really unnecessary to have 7 of them, because that's why a few of them, bashful, happy, become forgettable, because they're 7, right? Like, really, really weird. And I didn't like that Simon became evil either. That was a bit weird.
Yeah, I wasn't crazy about that plot point as well. Again, just seemed a bit unnecessary. They didn't need to put that in. But yeah, I think this is probably one of the most obvious references that they put in. And yeah, I didn't love it. I could have done without it. But of course, like you said, they're there to help her save the day. And of course, it's not only them that are there to help her save the day, because the queen, I forget her actual name, but the queen obviously betrays her husband and she joins forces with this group of 8 as well. And then we have another song, which is called
Knowing What I Know Now.
Knowing What I Know Now. I was going to say Can't Hold Us Down, and it was something along the lines of
it
that.
It really, this song also gives me Greatest Showman vibes. This, I don't know what it is. The whole soundtrack to me sounds a bit Greatest Showman. I really liked this. This is like, I think my favourite songs are, I love the parent one that's not actually about parents, the I Will Protect You, whatever it's called, that we spoke about for ages, At All Costs, love that. I also love the reprise of This Wish, and then Knowing What I Know Now, and then This Is the Thanks I Get, and then I don't particularly like any of the others. But yeah, I loved this, and yeah, we've got the 7 of them, because Simon's already turned at this point, and then there's that moment where the music stops and the queen walks in. And I remember being sat in the cinema like, please, please, please. And then the beat comes back in and she joins in and she's like, Knowing What I Know Now. And you're like, yes, she knows. And yeah, I've never seen, I can't think of another movie where, like, I definitely can't think of a movie where like a wife dobbs in a husband, like in a Disney movie. And there aren't that many where like an evil character realizes that they're working for an evil person. It happens occasionally, like it's not really the same, but like Percy from Pocahontas decides to stay behind with Miko and the Native Americans. He doesn't go back to England with Ratcliffe. I feel like Iago is in some of the sequels of Aladdin. He decides to stick around with Aladdin and Jasmine rather than... Well, that makes no sense, actually, because doesn't he get pulled into the lamp? Oh, he gets out, doesn't he, in Return of Jafar? Sorry, not canon at all, sequels. Yeah, there must be other villains that kind of turn against their master.
Yeah, I couldn't really think of one either. But then I guess, like, it's the first time we've really seen a villain with a partner, because most villains, if we think about it, are single people. They have sidekicks, of course, but this is different. She's not a sidekick. She's in a relationship with him. You know, she doesn't give in to his kind of wicked ways. And there's that line that she says in that song about... something about like she was, you know, blinded by the love, but over the years she's like seen the good in him, she's watched it fade. So this is something that she's been aware of for a while, and it's almost like maybe she's been a bit gaslighted by him and like stayed with him, but knowing that he's not all that good. And then it's taken like real act of evil for her to realize, because she talks him out of opening the Book of Forbidden Magic at one point in the movie. So I think she does know what he's capable of. But yeah, I would have liked to have seen more of her character. I really like that she broke away from him. And I really like that at the end of the movie, she was the one to kind of put him into the staff and send him into the dungeon. But I think that as a queen, we could have seen a bit more her. She could have had a bit more of a place in the story early on.
Yeah, and like at the end of the movie, her being the leader, it's like, well, is she capable of leading? Because it looked as though she was just the queen because she married Magnifico. We don't see any leadership from her. Like, obviously, she supports the other characters to try and kind of thwart Magnifico, which shows like a test of character. But that doesn't mean that she's a good leader. But she knows Magnifico well, but he knows her a little bit better, because when she goes to him and is like, oh, Ash is in the forest, whatever, unfortunately he sees through this plan and sends Simon disguised as himself, and he stays behind and tries to capture Star. And at this point, Magnifico is well on his way to becoming pure evil. We see his eyes turn green, so there is a little bit of that Disney villain green in his character design. And he has already been down to his lair. His dungeon is very reminiscent of the Evil Queen from Snow White. You've got that spiral staircase that leads down to the basement. And then when he's doing the potion down there, we even see the poison apple from Snow White on his desk. So he really has fallen into the depths of evil at this point. And this is the bit that gives me major Sleeping Beauty vibes, Maleficent vibes, that green kind of color that is like that lime green they use to signify evil. As I say, his eyes go that color, his powers and magic are that color. It's the color that we see in the end of Sleeping Beauty that we associate with kind of the thorns and the fire from the dragon of Maleficent. It's the same color that we see in Scar's lair when he's singing Be Prepared, that real lime green. It's a shocking color, and we have come to learn in a Disney movie that if we see that color, an evil character is doing an evil, evil thing. And I liked that we saw a little bit of that in him.
Yeah, I really liked his demise. I think that whole bit was really good. Again, found it very wishy-washy, found it very abstract, the fact that all the inhabitants of Roses, what's the word I'm looking for? I can't get my
residents.
Residents, that's the word, of Roses rose up against him, you know, with the encouragement of Asha. But again, we're all stars. Are you? What do you mean? What do you mean by that? Like, just, it was too abstract for me. I don't know what I would have liked to have seen as an alternative.
I know. It should have been, I'm responsible for my wish. Like, no one can make my wish happen apart from me. Give me my wish back it's my destiny. And that kind of is the message, because we see her grandfather making music, inspiring the younger generations. We see some of the, there's kind of the three wishes that keep being shown. There's a guy who's like climbed a mountain with a flagpole. There's a woman who's flying. We keep seeing those wishes recurring throughout the movie. It's that, like, that's what I think they're trying to get at with, like, I'm a star, but it's not spelled out. It should be like, I'm a star on my own. I can wish on myself. I can count on myself.
Yeah,
I don't need you. I don't need magic. I don't need a wishing star, because I am a star and I'm going to make my wish come true. But I kind of wanted Asha to have a bit of a monologue in which she like actually articulates that, like, I'm a star. I'm in control of my destiny. I wish on myself.
I think that would have been way more powerful and would have made her. I mean, I think she's a good role model anyway, but I think that would have been such a good message to deliver, because I think if this sort of message is lost on adults, then it's very much going to be lost on kids, and I don't think there would have been any harm in spelling that out.
Agreed. And I do think that's the message of the film, that as we've just said, it's not spelled out. And Asha also kind of trying to help us with that message a little bit. She has a bit of a change in her character design at this moment as well, and we see over her purple dress a blue robe with a pink bow, and I didn't get it at all. My sister straight away went,
I got it straight,
mother's cloak. Yeah, I didn't, but I liked that I didn't, and that when my sister told me, I went, oh yeah. Then they gave her a wand at the end, and I went, oh my god, it's her wand. Okay, yeah, you were right. But no, they couldn't leave it there. Then they went, you're like a real life fairy godmother. And it was, oh, for God's sake, come on. The cloak and the wand were enough.
I don't know how many times I've said it on this podcast, but I'm all about subtle Disney references and subtle nods. And yeah, if they'd have just left it, don't even give her the wand. Like, at this point, we know that we don't need magic. We know that everyone is going to be responsible for their own wish. You don't need to have this. This is just an artifact to make it even more obvious for people that maybe haven't got the cloak reference. But, you know, this is a nod to 100 years of Disney. Like, I don't know, I feel like you're rewarding all the fans here. I get that. But leave some stuff in there for, like, the hardcore people, please.
And then, of course, there was the worst Easter egg of the entire movie. Yeah, it does. It made me just go, absolutely not. So there's a woman who, again, we see it throughout the movie, a recurring wish. She wants to fly. And obviously Magnifico couldn't have granted that one. Again, I have empathy for him. You can't wish stupid things, right? So instead, Asha's like, I think it's Asha. It might have been one of the other characters, maybe Dahlia or somebody, is like, hey, I think her name might even be bloody Wendy, for God's sake. She's like, hey, Wendy, like, have you met this guy? He's trying to start a flight school. I'd like to introduce you to Peter. Now, if Peter had just been called Peter and had red hair, fine. If Peter had red hair and wearing a green outfit, that would have been okay. If Peter had red hair, a green outfit, a green hat, and a red feather in his hat, that also would have been fine. But no, Peter had red hair, a green outfit, a green hat, a red feather in his hat, and he had the face of Peter Pan. He had the actual face of Peter Pan, the bushy eyebrows, the turned up nose. It looked like that awful Peter Pan villain from the Rescue Ranger movies. You know, the old Peter Pan with like the stubble. It looked wrong.
It was a CGI Peter Pan, basically. I didn't like it either. What I also didn't like is they had already done a nod to Peter Pan earlier in the movie when Magnifico was kind of like going crazy and he went through three wishes and he was like, you want to, oh, what did he say? Something like, you. What? It was something, but he made a reference to Neverland.
He said, you want a magical nanny to look after your kids. Well, that's popping off or something, yes, like that.
It was that whole sequence.
And then he said, like, you want to wish, you want to fly, and somebody was like, well, that's going to happen. Well, Neverland.
They've already made one reference to Peter Pan. As we know, this is 100 years of Disney. There are so many other Disney films they could have referenced either there or at the end if they wanted to get another one in. They didn't need to shoehorn Peter Pan into it again.
I wouldn't have even cared if they did, as I say, if it had just been a guy called Peter in a green outfit. It was the face. It had the fact that it had the literal face of Peter. It was awful. Awful, awful, awful. So, Easter eggs. I wonder if there are anything, well, there probably are things in the movie that both of us missed.
Apparently there is 100 Easter eggs overall.
I've heard this too, and Ariana DeBose, who voices, I think it's Ariana, is it Ariana? That voices Asher, she said, if anyone can spot the Atlantis reference, I'll be incredibly impressed, or something like that. I did not spot that.
It's very clever because it does make me want to watch it again to spot more of them.
Absolutely. Now, my favourite Easter egg was the credits. And I stayed till the very end. The people were going around the cinema cleaning up after. Me, my sister, my mum sat there, and you see Snow White, then you see Pinocchio, and you're like, oh. So we stayed till the very end going, oh, what next? What next? Dumbo? Ah, no, Fantasia. Okay, now it's Dumbo. Okay, now it's Bambi. Oh, do you think they'll include Saludos and Ugos? Probably not. Oh, no, they've gone straight to to Ichabod and Mr. Toad. And we stayed until the very end. Now, some weird choices. No Rescuers. Thought that was really weird. They cut out like Meet the Robinsons, which I'm like, okay, fine. But then they had like Home on the Range. I'm like, why cut out Meet the Robinsons but keep Home on the Range? Very, very odd. They cut out all of the sequels. So we didn't have like Wreck-It Ralph 2 or Frozen 2 or Rescuers Down Under. But on the whole, a character from every single one of the Disney animated classics that's gone before was depicted in the credits. It was so simple. It was just a black background with the gold outline of a character with this wish, a different version of this wish playing in the background. And it was beautiful.
I didn't love it. No, I wasn't a fan. I didn't love it. I did, obviously we sat there until the end watching them all, but I don't know what it was about it. I just didn't love it.
Oh, I loved it. And I love trying to like guess.
It's that thing of like the subtlety. And I know that this is the credits and it wasn't in the actual movie, but I would have just, I think it would have been a lot cleverer if they'd have just peppered the film with subtle references. This was way too obvious for me.
Oh, I loved this. Okay, how would you have felt if it was like an apple and then like...
Yeah, that would have been better. That would have made more sense to me in what they were trying to do with the film rather than being like literal characters.
I think this is the problem, Tash. What they were trying to do with the film and what you wanted them to try and do are not the same. If they wanted it to be subtle, we wouldn't have the face of Peter Pan at the end of the movie. The dress of Aurora, not a dress like Aurora's, Aurora's dress, not a poison apple that looks a bit like the actual poison apple. There was no subtlety. There was a deer called Bambi. I mean, that's not subtle.
No, I know, that's what I mean. Like, there obviously are more subtle references in there because I did not spot 100 things while I was watching that movie. But yeah, I could have given or taken, or I could have gone without even all of those obvious ones.
Yeah, I think, so I've been doing a bit of research about some of the Easter eggs, and I think you'd be disappointed because some of the things, everything I've read online, I did see, but just didn't even think of it as an Easter egg. So it's things like, when the books are flying around Magnifico's office, that's an homage to the Sword in the Stone. And it's like, well, yeah, obviously, but it wasn't an Easter egg for me would be that one of the books on the shelf said the Sword in the Stone, but it was like really far in the background and you couldn't, I don't know. Like that would be more of, or, you know, a guy rides past on a horse in the background. If you pause it exactly this moment, it's the Headless Horseman. That's an Easter egg. These aren't even Easter eggs. These are, to me, these are influences saying, oh, the background's a watercolor inspired by Sleeping Beauty. That's not an Easter egg. That's an influence. But I think they're counting 100 influences.
Yeah. Oh, no, definitely. Yeah. I think they're calling them Easter eggs. But no, I totally agree. They're not what we would traditionally think of as an Easter egg.
Definitely not. But there was one kind of traditional Easter egg, but I don't even know if you can call it an Easter egg because it was so in your face. At the end of the credits, after the final character, who was that blob from Strange World, I mean, way to wrap up 100 years of Disney animation, we saw Asher's grandfather on the hilltop and he finally got his wish. Well, we assume he got his wish. He's still alive, so I don't know if he's inspired a generation or whatever it was he wanted to do, but he's playing on is it a mandolin, is that what they call those guitars, and he is playing the iconic song, and it's been rammed down our throats this year for Disney 100, When You Wish Upon a Star, which I think was the most appropriate song. Obviously it's got the word wish in there as well, And I liked that. And it made me happy that I'd stayed till the end of the credits looking at all these Disney characters because I got something out of it.
I agree. I know that was really obvious, that one. And what I've said is that I like subtlety, but I actually did really like that one as an obvious one goes.
Yeah, I feel like we're at the end of the movie now. Like we've literally gone through the credits and the post-credit scene. And it feels like we've been really negative about the film. I did like it. And I do think it's got a good soundtrack and good characters. I just would have liked it better without the references to Disney 100 and that, like, it felt, I feel like, I don't know, I feel like I either wanted them to create a movie that was like a classic fairy tale movie but wasn't as self-aware, so like we said, just another banger, like another Frozen, another Tangled, like a 21st century fairy tale, great, gigantic, would have been fantastic, but there we are. Or I would have liked maybe the story of a boy, I don't know why I say a boy, but a boy who falls into a storybook and like goes through like 100 years of, like, do you know what I mean? Really ram the 100 years down, but sticking a poison apple in the background and Aurora's dress, it did feel a little bit spoofy, a little bit cheap, a little bit like Shrek.
I was gonna say it's the sort of thing that you would see in Shrek, but yeah, I did really like it. I would give it a 7 out of 10.
Wow, 7 out of 10. God,
I think we rate things differently.
Do we?
Yeah, because I think five, I know five is like average, it's the middle, but I think five is bad.
No, five's average.
Yeah, I see. I think five is bad.
Like nothing's getting a 10. 10 is perfect, right? Encanto is a 9 for me.
Encanto is an 8 for me.
Frozen's a 9 for me. Frozen 2's an 8.
Frozen 2 for me is like a 6.
I thought you liked Frozen 2 better than Frozen.
No.
I thought you did.
No, I like the music better.
Oh, well, yeah. God, it's not a 5 because it's not an average movie. It's better than average. It's not a 7, though. I'm going to have to give it a 6.
There we go. A 6 and a 7. I mean, that's still pretty good.
Better than IMDb.
But do let us know what you thought. If you have seen the movie yet, if you agree with us, if you disagree, if there's any, what your favourite Easter egg was, let us know. As always, we can be contactable on Instagram at Chat Disney.
Or you can find us on Twitter or X at Chat Disney UK. And it is, of course, December, I think combined, probably our favourite month of the year. We are both well and truly in the Christmas spirit here on the Chat Disney podcast. So please join us for the next few weeks as we get into not just the Christmas spirit, oh no, but the Disney Christmas spirit, which is the ultimate Christmas spirit, if you ask me. And so for a little bit of that, do join us next Monday and the following one, and probably the following one, as we chat all things Christmas Disney.
Bye for now.
See you then.
Thank you. Goodbye now. Goodbye. Goodbye. Thank you. Goodbye.